This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the Ankler Podcast. This is Sean McNulty of the Wake Up Newsletter here at the Ankler, here in New York City on Thursday, April 4th. I'm joined by Elaine Lowe in Los Angeles. Richard got so inspired by the Disney annual meeting yesterday that he decided he had to go to Disneyland to test out all the rides, Elaine. So he's not here today. That's what it is.
That seems like a perfectly fair thing to do. I would have done the same.
He's a stickler for that quality control. He just, you know, must make sure the Igers, you know, has it controlled, you know, and Nelson's gone now. So somebody has to keep an eye on Bob Iger there.
Yeah, we're going to have to get the full food report from him, too, when he gets back. Are they, what's sure the food quality control over at thoughts. Disney?
Yeah, taking detailed notes for Mr. Iger, Richard, ever joking, but is enjoying a little downtime this week. So it's a two-hander today with good old Elaine and Sean. Wait, Elaine, how did you get top billing? What happened there?
I went in and tweaked your script a little, John.
Exactly. It's not, definitely not how I wrote it. But anyway, before we get started, just a reminder, you can catch the Ankler crew over on LA's number one NPR station and Southern California Public Radio's flagship radio station, 89.3 LAist, throughout the day every Thursday as part of their Entertainment Thursday programming during Morning Edition, Air Talk, and All Things Considered. And of course, you can reach us here at the podcast anytime at podcasts, plural podcasts, at theankler.com. Today, we're going to get into Elaine's great interview in her series business column with a top TV exec on the state of series buying, budget staffing, and much more. We have, well, it's a little bit of Paramount news, but if I can tell by Elaine's face, she's very excited to talk about that. So maybe we'll keep that somewhat brief, which is also the same look she gave me when I told her there was a Matrix movie and another Matrix movie coming. So very excited about that, Elaine.
I've actually seen all of them.
Yeah, are you in for a Matrix 5?
That's like a milestone for me. I mean, come on.
That is. In this podcast, that is 100%. All right, Matrix 5. Elaine is in. All right, good job mining that vault, Warner Brothers. Has the Warner Brothers reboot thing become a little bit comical by now, Elaine? Am I fair in that assessment, or am I being too hard on it in the newsletter?
Who isn't scraping from the bottom of the IP barrel? That's what I want to know.
All right.
Look, I'm in the middle of watching the new X-Men animated series on Disney Plus right now. So, Okay. Like, I'm not complaining about some of the IP barrel
scrapes
here.
IP. Fair enough. Fair. I stand down. Also, David Litsky is going to join us again this week to dive into all things Endeavor, making a lot of news this week and help me kind of pour one out for Endeavor as a public company come 2025 and dive into some very curious things to note about what's ahead for the assets that Ari Patrick and the team assembled over there over the past few years. So we'll dive into all of that. Ari Emanuel, Patrick Weitzel, good stuff there at Endeavor. And we'll, of course, give you the latest on the Anklers Players Tournament as the giants of our industry get down to the final rounds here to battle it out for, I think it's an Ankler hat, Elaine. Is that the prize we get for winning Hollywood?
I wear that hat regularly. It is a fine quality hat.
I have mine as well. Maybe we can throw in a signed 8x10 glossy from Richard. We'll see. We'll get creative on maybe, whatever we can sweeten the pot here. So anyway, we'll get into that. And finally, Elaine, we are up for a Webby Award. That's excitement,
yes,
on Elaine's
exciting face.
That's the Elaine's excited face.
Get all your right voting clickers out, guys. I don't know what that means, Sean.
you sound like Richard now, by the way. That's a very, get your clickers out, y'all. Okay, well, thankfully, we are taking care of that. The link to vote is in the show notes for the podcast here. It is also in the Thursday and Friday editions of The Wake Up, which you can access there at theankler.com. The link will be in there as well. So please vote early, vote often, or vote once, whatever you got for us at the Webbies. All right, shifting gears here. Elaine, are you a voting Disney shareholder?
No, but quite the little drama we've seen unfold and finally conclude, eh?
I haven't heard a thing. What do you mean? This is all news to me. I haven't not heard. Well, once again, the brave men and women at the Walt Disney Corporation have staved off an attack from those pesky activist investors who I think are actually the new villain in the new Star Wars film, Elaine. They're from the planet Triad. So I think they're really, really going all in on this. We're, of course, referring to Nelson Peltz, who only got about 30% of the vote for the seat he was up for on Disney's board. His other partner in crime there, Jay Rasulo, got about half of the amount that Nelson got for his seat. really not a lot of drama here. A lot of drama, certainly, but not a lot of in the end here, Lane. It wasn't a close race. It was not a horse race, I guess, in the end. We could categorize it as that.
Wasn't the real proxy fight the friends we made along the way?
Well, the problem is that we went through this already. This is Nelson's second try. As I put the GIF in, the wake up this morning, it's, Lucy and the football. I'm just like, it's the whole, not just Nelson. I mean, the media business falling mm-hmm. for this narrative. It was the conversations were, arguably the more heated, and they got a little more traction. But at the heart of Disney, Elaine, it's 40% of, or about 40% of the shareholders are quote unquote retail individuals. There is no John Malone, like at Warner Brothers Discovery, or, Sherry Redstone, who owns all the voting stock at Paramount. The biggest vote in the room here is the American public.
Which sees Disney very favorably. So, yeah, if your main backing is retail investors, it's to be expected, right?
Yeah, I mean, you look at the basics of this. I mean, I think, BlackRock is, the second largest shareholder, and it's like they barely own, I think it's a little over 4%, So there is no major block of votes as much as, the CalPERS can put their, support behind Peltz and whatever. They don't own a lot of the stock here to have a vote. So in the end, it's the math comes down to it. And, if you own any stock in any company, I'm sure you get things in the mail to vote for the shareholder meeting. And, if you don't send it in, generally that vote will default to the people that the company are supporting. So, again, not a lot of nothing because it's important, but I don't know.
Right. But now Disney can really turn its attention back to the main event, which also was obviously a point of contention here, which is figuring out the Iger succession plan and also figuring out how to drive streaming profitability, right? I mean, this is basically the train that we've been on for a little while now.
Yeah, pick your, ESPN D2C, the NBA deal, the companies, the theme parks, all the new Avatar, they're previewing the new Avatar ride that's going to be coming out. So yeah, there's so much on the horizon here to have to, fortunately, Iger can just move on from this and, tomorrow we'll forget all about this and we'll be back to business at hand. But for 3 months here, or at least 2 months solid, it's been pretty much the only headline bit that's been around the company. So a distraction for sure. But you did mention succession, which obviously is the forefront of the questions that Iger's getting these days. He's got about, a little more over 2.5 years before that the contract is up. But you just think, Elaine, he, in my opinion, handled the communication on this very well. He knows how to maneuver this. He's obviously been through it before with Nelson, not just, in general. But so as you looked at the candidates, Elaine, it's like who, it's not just about running the company. It's about dealing with this stuff. You can put the DeSantis Florida stuff into this as well, which is not about what's your plan for streaming or how do you turn around the movie division. Like, this is a big part of that job at Disney.
It's a big ask because you also have to have the charisma for arguably one of the most public-facing CEO roles in America. I mean, this is Disney, right? The most storied storytelling institution that we have, right? So yeah, you're right. It's not just about, hey, does this person know the theme park business as well as they know the TV business, which is a part of the conversation that I think anybody who's been talking about succession has been having, right? Oh, can this person who's been heading up TV and film, really understand the theme parks business? Can the person who's been operating theme parks, because we've done this before, wind up being somebody who can steer the whole company? But it's also a matter of having, your finger on the pulse of the cultural issues and sort of what matters, because Disney as a brand is such a proxy for some of these American values.
Yeah, and these are not going away. Whenever Iger leaves, there will be other activist investors, there will be other culture wars. This isn't just relegated to his reign. So you better have the confidence of the shareholders and of Wall Street that you can handle this and maneuver these. Very tricky, as we saw Chapek get tripped up in this stuff quite a bit, frankly, a few times before Iger came back in these kinds of matters where Bob may have known the numbers really well, but he did not get an A+ by any means in that regard. So
it's a tough seat to fill. Yeah, but hey, Iger told CNBC today that looking for his successor is the quote unquote board's number one priority. So we're back at it.
He was also, those clips, a much better CNBC appearance than the Sun Valley one, Elaine, I think, from last summer. We can all agree. But he also reminded us he's been there for 50 years now.
What? Iger has?
Yeah, he started there. He said Nixon was in office when I started in 1974.
Oh, wow.
I mean, he was at ABC, like a local TV affiliate, but like...
Yeah. I guess I think of him from his like 90s tenure, but yeah,
right.
That's
But
wild.
At the company, he's been an employee of the Disney company for 50 years. So Anyway, we'll just leave that there, I think. Hopefully Iger moves on and we all do as well. But why don't we go on to the TV business here, Elaine? So you talked to someone in a silhouette within a dark shadow this week, Elaine. What was going on in series business this week?
Yes, that's how my conversation took place with a voice changer and everything. No. I got a chance to talk to a very high-level studio production executive, somebody who really has a deep understanding of this space. Because, you know, I've spent the last several weeks, months now, talking to the producers and showrunners and writers, and then in recent weeks, prop houses and studio vehicle rentals, these businesses that really support production, just to get a sense of what everybody's seeing from their vantage point. And I wanted to know, if you're inside a network, if you're looking at something from a production point of view, how dire is this situation? You know, we hear a lot of sort of sky is falling rhetoric about the trajectory of the industry. And the person that I was talking to agrees that we're in the middle of where we are right now. It's sort of a fallow period, but, you know, really had a largely more optimistic view of things than I think some of the other folks I've talked to. You know, when I was asking about AI, they essentially said, you know, he doesn't want to downplay the potential issues, especially since, you know, we really have no idea where this technology is going to end up and how it will impact the creative process. But also noted that, you know, in their 30 plus years in the industry, we've seen technological changes. You know, we went from film to digital. You know, we don't cut audio tape anymore. Sure. You know, we don't like mimeograph things. We email things, or, you know, we Xerox them and now we emailed them.
We don't fax. No.
No. I actually had to look up what a Mimeo was after.
I was going to say, that's a little, where's, again, we need Richard. Where's Richard to give us the history of the mimeograph? Terrible.
But that, you know, largely we've learned to coexist with the technology in a way where it doesn't override the personal element of the artistic craft that everybody in this industry works in. And I think that's a very hopeful, optimistic view. Obviously, yeah.
We'll see where it goes. Exactly.
If you talk to anybody in the Writers Guild or SAG-AFTRA last year, they had much more pressing, urgent concerns about how something like AI is going to impact their craft. You know, certainly it's something that's part of IATSE's concerns as well when you're looking out into the future. But largely, the production exec I talked to hopes that it's a tool and not a replacement. Okay. And then, you know, just got into some of the other things. Like, I was asking, you know, with the IATSE negotiation cycles, like the thing that their focus has been on is, you know, the rest periods between filming and quality of life have always been large concerns for them. And so, you know, he kind of just broke down some of the sort of like domino effect of like, well, if you have this, if you have 10 to 12 hour shooting days, and then you have sort of like call times that sort of get staggered later and later, you know, here's what happens if you wind up having to add production days, because the additional cost of a production day is anywhere between like $200,000 and $400,000, depending on the scope of the project that you're working on. And he was saying, like, basically collectively looking at all of the labor cycles through 23 and 24, that it's going to significantly increase the cost of producing TV shows. And that's not to say that the unions don't deserve whatever they're able to negotiate and whatever both parties are able to agree to. It's just that this is going to be the logistical impact of it on production budgets.
This would be the WGA and the SAG agreements, which raised rates for
payment. Which raised rates, which impact the production cost, which is, I mean, you know, this is something that happens every cycle. So anyway, if you all wanted to read a little bit more about that, it's in this week's Series Business newsletter. And we also had a great Series Business newsletter from Minori this week.
Yeah. So she, of course, over there in the UK, kind of looking at, there was a departing message from a famed UK acting teacher. She kind of called her career at an esteemed British acting school after 42 years, which this letter spurred a hubbub, a kerfluffle. Elaine, what's the British term we should probably use here for this? I don't know.
Minori would know better than I do. But
Exactly. Yeah, Minori would know. Anyway, it set the UK creative community abuzz, I'll put it that way, igniting a conversation around, frankly, the quality of acting that's coming out of these esteemed UK performing schools, which have been traditionally focused on theater, where you go to cut your chops, and in the TV and streaming era, and how that's changing, Elaine, I think was kind of the crux of it there, right?
Yeah, so this legendary acting teacher, Patsy Rodenberg, had decided to resign from London's Guildhall School of Music and Drama after 42 years. And this is somebody who had taught Judi Dench, Ian McKellen, right, Daniel Day-Lewis, all of these British greats, and, you know, had told those around her that, quote, it has gradually dawned on me that my passions and belief in theater no longer fully resonate in the training of actors and actually aren't really understood in most theater companies around the world. And then went on to say that audiences need to know that they're in front of storytellers who can and want to tell a story, and that this requires dedication and craft. And it's this last word, craft, right, that has come into focus, you know, the sort of like voice and breath and movement techniques that actors employ, that classically trained actors employ, that she and others feel like are being eroded, especially as you see the rise of streamers like Netflix and Amazon, et cetera, which, you know, a lot of these have UK production hubs right now. And so many of these acting jobs gravitate toward TV and film instead of on a stage, which, I mean, in some ways is not a new conversation, right? It's a conversation that people have been having since the advent of TV and impact is on the craft of acting. But it seems as though in some views that this is something that had been happening for a while and now seems to be accelerating and is really just having an impact on, you know, the theater world.
So the more the jobs are shifting to that, and maybe theater, maybe not so much. So anyway, it's really fascinating read there from Minori. You can check that out over at theankler.com. All right, up next, David Litsky joins us to dive into all things around the future of Endeavor, including private jets for everybody. Well, that's exciting, Elaine. Oh, good. All right, the infamous succession clause, I think. You want one?
Yeah, put me on the list, please. Thank
you. What size do you want? What do you got? What do you want, DC-10?
I don't know. Whatever Taylor Swift rides, I'll take that. Is that on the market?
All right, we'll quiz David on that. Maybe he knows what's up. So anyway, we'll get to that and be back in a moment. All right, we're now joined by The Ankler's executive editor, David Litsky, who oddly enough came back on the pod this week, even though we have no Hello Larry talk. I'm sorry, we're fresh out, David. Are you okay with that?
I am, and I'm just glad to have defeated the ban that I self-imposed last week, so glad to be back.
Yeah, we'll ignore your resounding endorsement we got last week. So anyway, good to see you. Of course, outside of Disney and Paramount, which is, you know, anyway, we'll see what happens at Paramount, but Endeavor was leading a lot of the conversation around town this week. Of course, owns the big WME talent agency, among many other businesses, and whose CEO is, of course, the beloved Ari Emanuel. Just to lay out the basics here this week, essentially the financial backer of the company, a large private equity firm called Silver Lake, which had over 70% of the voting control of Endeavor, made a deal to take Endeavor private and thus eventually delist it from the stock market at some point when the deal closes, which is expected to close roughly 9 months, you know, early 2025 is the target date there. A lot of numbers flying around, but, you know, it values Endeavor at about $13 billion. That includes the debt of the company, which is, you know, a large premium, I think over 50%, 55%, David, something like that, over what the stock was trading at in October when they announced that the company was exploring options, David, I guess. I don't know what the exact term was for this process to happen.
Yeah, the strategic review, I believe.
There you go.
Something in that neighborhood.
Yeah, exactly. Endeavor, of course, also owns 51% of the TKO company, which owns the WWE and the UFC. So Silver Lake will be getting that stake.
I hope everyone at home is taking copious notes, because there could well be a quiz with all these numbers.
I was trying to keep the numbers. I was like, how many numbers do I want to dive into here? But, you know,
does Elaine, everybody still have their Endeavor AK filing open right now?
No, I closed mine finally. Anyway, so David, Endeavor will have been a public company in the end here for, you know, about 3-ish years, depending upon when exactly the timeline goes here. So we'll pour one out for the EDR stock. But, you know, give us a big picture view of Endeavor's life as a public company. What's kind of the epitaph here, or what's the arc in your mind?
Sure. So Endeavor actually first filed to go public in May of 2019, so almost 5 years ago. Sure. And what was remarkable at that time, you know, in the initial prospectus, was that there was a subtext that really seemed to indicate that certainly Ari and Endeavor's management knew that tech had really overrun entertainment. And so there was very much a concerted effort to position Endeavor as a tech company. There was 89 references to its platform over time. Once it did go public in 2021, that evolved into another bit of sort of tech business jargon, where Endeavor loved to talk about its flywheel, which is a term generally associated with Amazon. So there was a lot of effort to, we're innovators, we're disruptors, you know, we're looking around the corner. And, you know, I think that basically you know, even from the beginning, there was a lot of skepticism around it. People were concerned about the debt from the very beginning. They did try to go public in 2019, had a incredibly poor market timing. WeWork, which, you know, people may recall from the Apple series or whatever, but that blew up within like a week of when Endeavor was supposed to go public or thereabouts. And so they pulled it. And then, of course, the pandemic happened. They didn't come back out until spring of 2021. So, I mean, the numbers, you know, their life as a public company, you know, were okay. But I think basically just investors never fully bought it. And I know that, you know, every public company CEO will complain that, you know, they're misunderstood or their company isn't as valued as much as it should be, of course. But here, I think there really was a pretty significant disconnect between all the assets that, you know, Ari and company had put together into Endeavor. And, you know, just I think investors looked at it and just didn't quite know what to do, particularly in that, you know, Wall Street likes predictability. And, you know, there's just not predictability in this business. You know, as much as like earlier this year, Endeavor had a huge win negotiating the rights deal with the NCAA and ESPN, almost $1 billion, 8 years. But they can't count on that every quarter. They can't count on, you know, those numbers consistently going up every 3 months. And so the lumpiness and just, yeah, basically investors don't like that. You know, Richard wrote about this a couple weeks ago in his perverse incentives piece. And, you know, I think it's really hampering all of entertainment. And Ari, as much as he tried to present himself and Endeavor as sort of different, just it just didn't work.
Yeah.
As an aside, I think lumpiness is my favorite Wall Street hedgy, fudgy word for things are slightly off.
We are going to get a lot of that term this year because of lumpiness from the strikes. So we're in free cash flow. So you're in luck, Elaine. Come and join me on the Q1 earnings calls in a few weeks.
Love to hear what their plan is for the lumpiness.
Yeah, you'll get plenty of that answer. But David, you know, the thing that I loved personally most about Endeavor being a public company is that we got quarterly financial insight into a pretty, you know, clandestine part of our industry, the agency business. You know, the WME was on the books. We actually were both talking about this a bit. The streaming boom had quite an effect. You know, you could kind of see it in their revenues to a degree. I mean, granted, there was other growth going on, but I think it was going from around $895 million or so revenue in 2016 to, I think it was a peak of $1.9 billion, you know, in 2021. And the last 2 years has been over $1.5 billion each year. And that's with last year being the strikes as well. That was still maintained in 2023. So that was an interesting part that we're gonna lose that insight now. I mean, you know, as much as I email CAA, they don't tell me how their money breaks down, unfortunately. So David, you and I both looked at those numbers at the agency, and also Endeavor Content was built into that too. And there was, of course, the big writer's revolt about packaging that kind of affected that business and caused them to sell 80%. So any thoughts there on the agency side of this equation?
Yeah, I think one, there was definitely a time in the mid-2010s, let's say, where there was definitely a hope that all of the agencies would end up going public. And yeah, we've seen, you know, obviously only Endeavor ultimately got out. You know, CAA ended up, right, getting acquired by Francois Pinault and his family. And, you know, I think UTA is almost certainly going to remain private, having seen everything. So, yeah, so that is disappointing in the sense of, I think transparency is valuable. And the more people understand these things, the easier it is to, you know, sort of for people to make better deals and such. You know, I think that, yeah, the Endeavor Content thing and the Writers Revolt, you know, is sort of an under-discussed sort of part of this. You know, one of the things that struck me from having followed, you know, Endeavor and its sort of precursor, WME, IMG, and all of the eras before that, you know, is that, yeah, they were very good, I think, at sort of capturing cultural moments. I worked on a story in my previous life on the company in 2016, and I remember vividly having turned it in, you know, I had ended the piece and turned it in, and my editor at the time, you know, sort of sat on it for a few days and then at some point called me into his office, and it was a meeting with not just him, but all my colleagues. And this was, I want to say, probably September 2016. And basically the subtext of the meeting was, what's all this red state stuff? And because it was all about the Miss America pageant and, you know, look at all, everything we're doing with Brad Paisley and, you know, and right, we've got PBR, the bull riding and, right, you know, the UFC. And there was definitely a sort of, you know, at that moment, this sort of confusion about that. And then, of course, a couple months later, you know, with the election, it was like, oh, well, maybe Ari really could see around corners and sort of, captured something happening in the zeitgeist. So I would say then a few years later, there was a blind spot with the writers and maybe more of a left-leaning perspective that led to them being upset about packaging. And they sort of missed it and they didn't really adapt to it. And I think they were really betting on Endeavor content, you know, and the ability to do those deals to be a significant growth driver in the future. And I don't think that's dispositive as to why it's going private, but definitely a factor, you know, and something that, like I said, is not being sort of looked at as sort of a meaningful moment in its journey.
Of course, they had to sell 80% of that Endeavor content division, which is now called Fifth Season. They still own 20%. We'll see if they hold on to that, David. But, you know, you had the pleasure of this morning getting a classic Sean late deep night dive into a financial document in today's Wake Up, which I hope you enjoyed that waking up to that this morning.
Again, another achievement unlocked in my time here. So, yes, very
exactly.
much so.
Like, what is this? 8K? Okay, great. Nothing like waking up to that to dive into edit. So, you know, looking ahead here, David, once this deal closes, assuming, you know, it goes through again in about 9 months, you know, what can we expect here? I dove into this both of us in the 8K diving into all this stuff. There's a lot of incentives in this 8K to kind of sell off the company, except for WME and the TKO stake and essentially using that to, I think, pay for taking it private. If I'm going to put it in one sentence, that seems to be what the incentives are for the top Endeavor brass here.
Yeah, to use the classic financial bit of wisdom is, show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcome. So, I do think that the money that is attached to particularly Mark Shapiro's performance in selling off assets and the potential for a $100 million payday if, you know, he succeeds in doing so on a admittedly unstated list of assets. So, you know, we don't know. We only know what's not on the list, said, is the agency and the representation business and the TKO stake. So, clearly there's that. And to use another bit of, you know, again, forgive me, you know, overused sort of business wisdom, is there are two ways to make money. And there's a bundling and unbundling. And so,
as we're all becoming very familiar with your many fields,
the top people are going to make money both ways. And so I think that, again, is sort of what we're seeing here. And, you know, they love making deals. You know, I think part of Endeavor's problem, at least in terms of its narrative, has always been that it's sort of very complicated. And I think that, they're going to unwind it, but they clearly like complicated deals. And I think that that will continue. I mean, they'll sell off these pieces and they'll probably end up adding up to pretty good numbers. One, because they're good at it. Two, I think a lot of those properties almost certainly have value, but that didn't necessarily mean that they had value altogether, you know, in one bundle. In this case, that bundle being, EDR.
So, exactly, selling off the parts, they may be worth more separately than they were together. But I'll round out here with centering, on TKO, which is doing very well. The UFC and WWE are, you know, both doing very well. Their WrestleMania is this weekend. I'll be there for to check out the action in Philadelphia. But, you know, so they will have 51% of the company, which could be a bigger thing that Silver Lake wants to focus on in the future. I mean, the other owner here, Vince McMahon's been dumping shares like it's going out of style. I think he's, down to about maybe something like a 7% stake at this point. It's what he still has. Those shares are just going on the open market. Silver Lake and Endeavor haven't been buying those, but there's a big float out there, David. If they wanted to get more meaningfully into a sports-centric company at a time where sports rights and things are not in a high commodity here, what is your take on where that this TKO element of the story could go?
Yeah, well, I do think that we are, again, perhaps somewhat underestimating that while they are going private with Endeavor, they do still run a publicly traded company in TKO. Yeah. We will still hear from, you know, Ari and Mark
and Mark, you know,
the gang every quarter with that. And I'm definitely just making an inference here, but I think that, they clearly have been interested in the sports business for a while, and they see how hot it is and how global it is, and I think they see a lot more opportunity there. And so my guess is, beyond the unwinding deals at Endeavor, that any acquisitions are probably going to be under the TKO banner, because it's just a much cleaner story.
Yeah.
They're a sports/sports entertainment company, and that, that's something people understand. There are so many events, it can be a lot more predictable revenue, And I think that a lot of energy and attention is going to be in that direction.
Right. I would agree. Yes. And Elaine, to loop it up here, just so you know, Ari and Patrick are both getting planes. So just so you know, they're apparently Endeavor owned a lot of planes. This is news to us all, I think.
Well,
so
that's a load off my mind.
So they'll be fine. They can still get around in the private air world travel. So that was part of the deal as part of this contract. But anyway, you can go read the full breakdown or broken down in terms of the numbers, all the top execs can get in terms of their bonuses, what they are getting when the deal even closes, as well as what Patrick Weitzel will be up to. He's got some seed money from Silver Lake and seems to be, again, has some optionality, I'll put it that way, to start his new shingle, to do something new here, maybe another act here in the entertainment business, probably in about 2 years or so, seems to be about the timing. But anyway, wrote that all down in the Wake Up today. You can check that out over at theankler.com. And Elaine, moving from one set of players to another. See what I did there? Did you see that?
It's cute, yeah. Sean.
I wrote that myself, so pretty proud of that one. So anyway, David, we need the latest on the Anklers Hollywood Players Tournament, which I will remind you, remind listeners, a little background that all Anklers subscribers should know. The Anklers is running a Players Tournament, which is kind of a March Madness style bracket tournament, pitting executives from various eras in Hollywood against each other, where eventually one exec from each era will face off in a final four for the ages, the eras being old Hollywood, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls of the 70s and 80s, the big IP era of the 90s and 2000s, and the streaming era of the 2010s up to now. You can still get in on the final voting action this weekend over at theankler.com before the victor is crowned early next week. But David, what is your kind of leading the charge here in the voting process and monitoring and seeing how the results are coming in? What have we got?
Yeah, well, a lot of what you would expect in terms of lower seeds advancing. We do have, I believe, it'll be Walt Disney moving forward in the old Hollywood bracket. We'll see if it ends up ultimately meeting Bob Iger from the current era bracket, which will be fun if that shakes out. That would be in the Final Four on Saturday. We're still in the voting as we record for the Sweet 16. But yeah, we got some fun. There is sort of a Cinderella bracket, which is coming out of the 90s, 2000s, big IP era, where a lot of the mid to higher seeds are doing rather well. Tom Cruise, who was a 10 seed, James Cameron, who is 11 seed, the Pixar Brain Trust of John Lasseter and Ed Catmull, who are 5 seed, have been doing well. So, that one is the one bracket that is not chalk. So that's fun. Okay. So, I think we are headed towards at least one Cinderella in the Final Four. So that'll be exciting.
Got to have one. All right. Again, you can go over to theankler.com and vote over there. And another great piece that just dropped today here from Peter Kiefer has a great new read. I want to bring Peter in now. So first of all, Peter, welcome. Good to see you. Nice to see you as always.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Happy to be back.
So you wrote, you dove into the world of EAC, which I will also...
Is that how you pronounce it?
I hope so.
Yes,
Peter?
That is EAC. How you pronounce it.
Rolls off the tongue.
EAC, it's short for Effective Accelerationism.
All right, sounds classy.
Yeah.
You can see why it's abbreviated.
Yeah. I guess so. Yeah, it does make some sense.
And it piqued my curiosity. I had been reading about it as this new movement that was coming out of Silicon Valley. It has several very prominent advocates that are pushing it out there. Mark Andreessen is the one we focused on highly in our piece. But Sam Altman of OpenAI big into it. There are several others many others up in Silicon Valley. But the idea was, I thought, interesting and ominous for not only our industry, but many industries. And I thought it was an opportunity to introduce our readers to it, which effective accelerationism is this notion that progress is the most important thing for humanity, and that anything that tries to slow the speed of technological progress should be effectively destroyed. And any sort of things that could slow down progress are seen as enemies to this movement. And that's everything from, regulations.
Right.
In some forces, you could say unions. In some ways, it could be some forms of government. It's a pretty crazy and intense type of philosophy. And I think that the reason why I was interested in writing about it and introducing it to our readers was because I feel like these ideas coming out of Silicon Valley are way more important for us to understand at this point in the evolution of the entertainment industry. We've all seen the way that technology has, encroached upon the traditional studio and network system in a way. And I feel like these things that were once sort of, we could roll our eyes at Silicon Valley 10, 15 years ago, we no longer can do those things. So it's kind of this interesting movement. And we sort of decoded it and then also kind of got into some of these companies that are sort of focused on AI and how AI could impact the entertainment industry, because much of the reason why effective accelerationism is happening now is because we're in the early era of the sort of AI revolution, which is clearly on everyone's mind in the entertainment industry.
Sure.
So, Sean, for example, you know, earlier this week you wrote about OpenAI previewing its
voice tool.
And yeah, there are other tools that, you know, that offer that. And yeah, one of the things in Peter's story is a different venture capitalist than Mark Andreessen extolling the virtues of this kind of technology, because it just basically eliminates all the friction that comes from humans.
People,
and,
right. Yeah, exactly.
And then
people costs, whatever you call it. Yeah, yeah. Right.
And then my favorite part is, yes, there's always the inevitable, like, you know, yes, there will be, you know, there may be jobs lost, but, you know, ultimately, you know, everyone, you know, will find their way and people, you know, will have new jobs, yes, and they'll be freed up to focus on their creativity. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. Like, this is people's creativity. Like their ability to act with their voice is creative. The ability to, you know, record this well and make it sound great is creative. So if that's being taken away by AI, then what other creativity am I supposed to lean on? But so it's definitely something to reckon with and to take seriously.
Yeah. And it's just the newest front. And I think in this ongoing, you know, battle or tension between the, you know, the forces of Silicon Valley and the traditional studio network system, this is just, you know, the newest iteration of that. And it's pretty wild stuff. So I hope everyone checks it out.
Yeah. Yeah. And did you guys see the Jon Stewart thing this week from Monday? He also dove into AI and just was many of those clips you're talking about, David, he was putting in there, which is like, you know, people trying to talk around that this is going to kill a lot of jobs, and just the verbiage they were using to, you know, essentially say that, yeah, this is going to be a lot of layoffs and, you know, things like that, and showing Mark Zuckerberg using AI to make toast, which was pretty hilarious. So anyway, just a plug to check out that Jon Stewart clip this week. So they didn't want to call it EA, Peter, EAC, you know, it's right there, I guess. Is that, you know, did you ask about the name? Or
I think part of the problem was, again, this is a level of knowledge that I'm genuinely embarrassed to know, but effective accelerationism is a sort of effort to move past what was previously called EA, which was effective altruism, which is associated with Sam Bankman-Fried, and you know, obviously was recently sentenced to 25 years in jail.
Oh wait, we don't want to be associated with him anymore. Is that?
I think the answer is no. I'm sorry.
If any of our listeners can actually figure out exactly what effective accelerationism is, please call me, because I did my best. I listened to a lot of podcasts.
You'll get an Ankler hat.
It gets into some pretty wild stuff that is way beyond my intellectual pay grade. So I would love the help.
Okay, fair enough.
But I do think the ultimate answer is just the unfettered technological optimism.
Yeah. Let it roll. All right, let it roll. Yeah. All right. Well, you can check that piece out over at theankler.com for sure. And we'll wrap up over at the box office. Of course, we have Elaine, Monkey Man versus The Omen. You know, listen, I've heard of worse combo movies for a sequel, Elaine. I'd see that movie, quite frankly.
I don't do horror movies, so one of those is already automatically out. Apologies. I'm sure it's fine.
Elaine's pull quote again. I'm sure it's fine, said Elaine Lowe from The Ankler.
Is there a Monkey Omen hashtag meme?
Yeah, okay. Now we're thinking. All right. I don't know. Peter, are you in for a Monkey Man movie, or where are you at on?
I'm into it. I was reading about the interview with Patel where he said it was the horrors of actually shooting it, and he had to, like, you know, I think he had to turn to his iPhone, and it was kind of a crazy story about how he got that whole thing made and done. So I'm excited to see it.
Yes, it's Dev Patel, of course, who stars and directed the movie. I thought this campaign's fantastic. If this wasn't going up against the Women's Final Four tonight or WrestleMania tomorrow, definitely would be at the theaters to check it out. But I hope it does well. Again, a new voice would be nice. A new auteur would be nice to have in Hollywood. So hopefully that delivers. They're both tracking around 13 million to low teens. So we'll see who comes out on top. I'll, of course, cover that in my box office breakdown in the Wake Up on Sunday night. And Elaine, you'll be back with more serious business next week with Minori?
Yes. Well, I have to. No, we've got some good stuff.
Well, I hope so.
The thing about a weekly newsletter, Sean, is you have to put one out every week. Huh? Nobody really told me about that when I started this.
Yeah. In my defense, you didn't ask me about, like, hey, Sean, do you do that every day? I'm like, yeah, no, I do it every day. Yeah, no, we've got some
good stuff on tap as always.
All right. Well, I love a good surprise. You can, of course, check that out at theankler.com. And remember to vote for the Ankler in the Webbies again. That link is right there in the show notes. You'll see on your phone before you delete this pod episode. Just go ahead and click in there, take 15 seconds and give a vote if you would. The link is also in the Thursday and Friday editions of the Wake Up at theankler.com. You can, of course, email us here at the pod anytime at podcasts@theankler.com and follow The Ankler on the socials at The Ankler across your favorite platform of choice. David, Peter, Elaine, a pleasure as always. Richard, we missed you. We'll look forward to your Disney food report next week. And, of course, finally, a big thanks goes out to all of you for listening. We'll see you next time.